Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Hello, you're with the All in the Mind podcast. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Today, a moving, poignant, and sometimes very funny account of how one family faced Alzheimer's disease.
Every single night I'd say, "Hi Dad, how are you? Good. How's Mum? Good. She did everything she had to do." I guess just breathing is constitutes that. And then I'd say, "And how was your day?" And he'd say, "You know what? They're not right in the head in here." I'd say, "Dad, it's a dementia ward. Yes, they're not right in the head, but they don't know they're not right in the head, and it, you know, they don't mean it." And there was one resident that we called the Whistler, because he would walk around all day and he would just go and couldn't really whistle, but just kind of suck air in and make this whistling sound. And Dad said he does it all day and he just does it to get on your mum's goat.
Michelle Wyatt, first-time author of the book Not Right in the Head. Growing up, Michelle thought that her grandmother was a bit crazy and often hilarious. It turned out that she had Alzheimer's disease, which can run in families. Then Alzheimer's took over her own mother's life, and the family began on the challenging journey once more. But Michelle Wyatt again found a funny side to the experience, and she wanted to share it with others.
The reason I decided to write the book was because I had had so many conversations with people I knew that had a loved one or a family member that was dealing with Alzheimer's. And you always share stories about, you know, how tough it is and how hard it is. But often the conversation would end up talking about the nursing homes or, you know, the place where they're cared for and all the funny things that happen there. There are some quite interesting sights that you see when you spend a bit of time in a nursing home. And then we would always end up laughing. And I thought, that's so funny that you start off a conversation talking about a terminal illness that is very depressing and very confronting and very tough on everybody it involves. But having these conversations, we always end up laughing. I thought, that's such a wonderful thing. And maybe there is something that we can do to help share these stories with everyone, because everyone can relate to these kind of stories. And everyone has somebody that steals something at the nursing home or runs around with no pants on. Everyone's seen it. And as tough as it is, it's always nice to sort of sit there and say, okay, it is a little bit funny and it's okay occasionally to laugh at it. Not that you're laughing at them, but you're laughing at the situation. And I think that's why I wanted to write it, is to just show everyone you're not alone. We all do it. We all have a smile at it and it's okay.
Michelle Wyatt recalls the early signs of her mother's Alzheimer's disease, which seemed to creep up on the family.
So Mum was worried that she was then going to succumb to it. You know, Mum would say things like, "If I ever end up like you, Nana, put me in a home and throw away the key." She would say that, and we'd all laugh, and it was hilarious, and never really expecting it to happen. It's sort of, you just never think that these things are going to happen. So for Mum, she would start to forget names and withdraw from conversation. And for the longest time, even though I probably knew that this is what was coming, I denied it. And I think my dad did as well. And we just sort of put it down to the fact that Dad had retired. He was doing everything for Mum after, you know, they'd been together 60 years. So we kind of dismissed some of the early signs. And by the time she was sort of full-blown Alzheimer's, you know, we'd sort of missed the boat in terms of trying to really work with her on how we could help make this journey a little bit easier for her.
And how was it affecting your father before she eventually went into a nursing home?
Well, Mum and Dad had an amazing marriage and relationship. You know, they dated when they were teenagers, and so they did everything together. And I think Dad would have seen the signs earlier than us, I would think. And I think he possibly to some degree covered them up from the family. So that's probably why he started finishing her sentences for her and wouldn't let her drive and started cook the meals and all those sorts of things. So for him, it would have been really, really hard. And towards the end of the time where they were living together and she was in the home or in the new unit that we had got for them, she was becoming incontinent. She wouldn't eat. So Dad would get up in the morning and get her in the shower, change the sheets and do all that. And a lot of the time would shield that from us and not tell us. You know, he was proud and he didn't want to embarrass Mum, obviously. And for him, a lot was happening before we were actually really aware of it.
And when she went into a nursing home, your father sounded absolutely amazingly devoted, that he just sat with her for days on end.
He did. He was worried that something would happen to her. You hear about these stories how, you know, a lot of the time people have falls in these nursing homes. So he would get up at 8 a.m. and sit with her from 8 a.m. and then he would be there all day, leave there at 8 p.m. and head home. So he just wanted to make sure she was being fed, she was being looked after. We used to laugh and say Mum was probably the only person in the history of the world that checked into a nursing home and put on weight, because he would sit there and shovel food in her mouth all day. So, yeah. Yeah, he was just really conscious of making sure she was well looked after.
So your father, having spent so much time in the dementia ward with her, knew the dispositions of just about everyone. Tell me some of those stories.
Well, it's funny, and this is how the title of the book came about, is, you know, Dad was there 12 hours a day and then he would call me at 8:30 at night. And the conversation was the same every single night. I'd say, hi, Dad, how are you? Good. How's Mum? Good. She did everything she had to do. It's like, okay, I don't know what that is. Breathe, I guess. You know, she wasn't verbal and she couldn't talk and she couldn't feed herself. She couldn't walk. So, you know, I guess just breathing is constitutes that. And then I'd say, and how was your day? And he'd say, you know what? They're not right in the head in here. I'd say, Dad, it's a dementia ward, yes. They're not right in the head, but they don't know they're not right in the head, and it's, you know, they don't mean it. And he said, well, so-and-so did this. And there was one resident that we called the Whistler, because he would walk around all day and he would just go and couldn't really whistle, but just kind of suck air in and make this whistling sound. And Dad said, he does it all day and he just does it to get on your mum's goat. I was like, Dad, he probably doesn't even know he's doing it, let alone doing it to annoy somebody. So I would hear stories every night about what the Whistler was doing and what every other person in there was doing, and they were all doing it just to upset Mum, according to Dad.
And there was another story about your aunt with Alzheimer's also being a procurer of things that weren't her own. Tell me the story about her collecting other people's glasses.
Well, my cousin tells a story that, you know, she went to the nursing home one day to visit her mum, and she had a different pair of glasses on. And she said, Mum, where'd you get those glasses from? And she said, oh, I don't know, I found them somewhere. I've lost my own glasses and I found them. And then, you know, 2 days later, went back, she had another pair on, asked the same question. She kept saying, I don't know where they've come from, but I found them. And then I think the third time it happened, my cousin was like, okay, something's not right here. So she went into her room, had her search around, pulled out all the drawers and found like about 20 pair of glasses in the back of her sock drawer. So she questioned her and she was like, I don't know how they got there. And so I think, you know, my auntie just used to go around and find glasses lying around and pick them up. So my cousin took them back out into the communal living area in a bag. And when she opened the bag, she said there were hands coming everywhere grabbing these glasses from her. Even people that didn't wear glasses were grabbing them saying, these are mine, these are mine. And my cousin had glasses on and they got ripped off her face. And she said it was unbelievable, just people trying to get everything they could with their hands on these glasses that weren't even theirs. It was hilarious.
And I guess some of these stories highlight the behaviours that people with Alzheimer's can get stuck in, some repetitive behaviour.
Yeah, and it's interesting because often the brain will take you back to a different period of time in your life. And I talk about this in the book how, you know, hopefully when if I do end up with Alzheimer's, that my brain takes me back to a much younger and prettier and slimmer me.
You wish.
Wouldn't that be nice if you could choose when you actually go back in time? But you see, like, a lot of nursing homes have these little nurseries set up with babies and cots, you know, dolls and things. And people go back to this other time in their life, and one would hope that they're going back to a happier time. And that makes you kind of feel pretty good about the fact that these people, even though they're not functioning properly and they're not in the moment, that they're actually probably in a place where they were at their happiest. And there was one guy in Mum's nursing home, Bobby. He was used to be a fisherman, and we'd spoken to his family about it, and he loved to fish. So he would sit in his wheelchair and he had one of those big, I think they're called princess chairs, and you sort of lie back a bit in them. And he would just cast out an imaginary line every day, all day, just sit there and flick his wrist, and we'd go past and say, they're biting Bobby. And he'd go, aye, aye, they're biting. He was this old Scotsman. So it was just nice to see some of these people that when they're, you know, going back to these other parts of their life, that they seem to be quite happy and content in that era, whatever it was.
So it is very reassuring when they seem to have found a happier place. But an awful thing about watching someone with this disease sometimes is really not knowing what's going on in their head, and you're imagining the worst.
Yeah.
What was that like for you to watch your mother?
We were very lucky in that the doctors got the medication right, and there are so many side effects with Alzheimer's that can present, from depression to anxiety, that can manifest in all sorts of ways, of violence and anger. So for Mum early on, she would cry a lot and couldn't really verbalise why she was crying. So the doctors sort of played with the medication a bit and got that under control. So she never really displayed any of the sort of odder behaviours that you do see. But there was one time when she would only eat for me during a period of time. So I would go down and feed her. This is while she was still in the home, in her house. And I was in the kitchen. She turned around and she had a knife in her hand. She said, "I'm going to kill you dead with this knife." Mm. And I was like, wow. And my mother was very placid and loving. I never heard her yell or scream at anybody except for me, because I was a naughty kid. But And that was a bit confronting for me. And I can imagine what it would be like for families, you know, where their loved one is expressing these kind of behaviours and, you know, being very violent to someone. It's not only horrible to see your own loved one going through it, but then the person that they're unleashing their anger on, it would just be horrible.
You also write that love can be fickle in dementia wards. What did you see there in relation to love?
Well, one time I saw this couple walking around, and they'd both arrived around the same time, and they were walking around holding hands. And I thought, oh, that's nice, because there was a beautiful couple that had been in the nursing home, Gwen and Len, that had been there for a while. So they were a married couple that had checked in together. And there were this other couple that I started seeing walking around the corridors holding hands, and I walked up to a carer and I said, oh, they look like a lovely couple. What's their story? And she said, oh, they're not together. They've just found each other in the last day or two and they think they're together. And I was like, well, that's nice. Yes.
And there was a dementia patient called Gladys who took a shining to your father when he visited.
She did. And she was quite adamant that Dad was her property and no one was going to come between them. And I mean, she loved Mum. Like, she would walk up to Mum and talk to her and see if she was okay. But she just loved Dad. She wanted to sit next to him all the time, wanted to be with him. And she knew that we were his family. And every time we'd come, she'd be perched right next to him. And if Dad would get up, she'd follow him. And every time he turned around, she would be behind him. And every night when he would leave, she'd be on the balcony waving to him. And so, yeah, she loved him. She absolutely loved him. And it was just gorgeous to see the relationship. And I think sometimes Dad got a bit frustrated that, you know, she was sort of got in the way occasionally when he was trying to look after Mum. She would always make sure that she was right at his elbow. So,
Did you reflect on what it must have been like for your father to be so devoted to your mother, yet she often just stared blankly back at him?
Yeah, it must have been tough. I mean, but part of me thinks that Mum knew that Dad was there the whole time, because she, you know, they had such a strong bond, and she would react to him a little bit. She couldn't really acknowledge us at all. We would try and talk to her or get some answers out of her. And that's one of the hardest things, obviously, with Alzheimer's. It is just so hard to not know what is going on in their mind. And, you know, part of you thinks, I hope they don't know what's going on. And then the other part of you thinks, I'm glad they don't know what's going on. You know, it's a dilemma, not knowing. But Dad was there, and I think the fact Mum lasted so long, she was 13 years, which is quite a long time to have the disease. I think that was due to the fact that Dad was there and she was content and she was well looked after, and possibly she knew that he was there, but you can only hope.
Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you find me.
I'm Lynn Malcolm, and I'm speaking with Michelle Wyatt, author of Not Right in the Head. It's an intimate, moving and funny account of how she and her family dealt with their mother's Alzheimer's disease. You talk about that sometimes it was better to tell little white lies to Alzheimer's patients to keep them happy and less agitated. That's a difficult one, isn't it, to just know when to tell the lies and when not to tell the lies?
It is difficult. Like, a friend of mine, her grandmother went into a nursing home and she had dementia, so didn't quite know where she was or who everyone was, but will continue to ask for her husband and he had passed years before. So the family decided that it was best to just give her a little white lie every time she asked and said, oh, no, Pop's just gone down the shops, Nan, and he'll be back soon. And that seemed to sort of cure her for that moment of wanting him, and then she'd move on to something else. And every time she asked, they would just say the same thing again. And so that helped get her through. But there's different techniques that nursing homes and all that use for various patients when they do it. I saw a documentary a long time ago when Mum was first diagnosed, where there was a man that kept asking for his wife, and she had passed a long time ago. So the staff had decided that this was the best therapy for him, was to write down on a little piece of paper that his wife had passed years before and now she was up in heaven and quite happy. So they put the bit of paper in his pocket, and every time he would walk up to a staff member and say, oh, where is Kathleen? Where is my wife? They would say, take out the piece of paper and read it. And he would read it and say, she passed years ago, but she is happy in heaven. And he would cry for a minute and then he would be okay and walk away. And they would do that 2-3 times a day. For me, that was an odd thing to do, because I can't imagine watching someone go through that grief 3 or 4 times a day. But you've got to trust that these different therapies work for different people, and there's different ways of dealing with it, I guess. Some families choose to tell a little white lie just to make their relative feel better, and others feel it's better to just continue to tell the truth and deal with it, get it over and done with, and then move on.
So what were your thoughts and observations about the staff and carers in nursing homes for dementia patients?
We are still friends with a lot of the carers that looked after Mum. They do an amazing job. I mean, it's thankless most of the time, because in dementia wards especially, you know, the patients in there, a lot of them are nonverbal and a lot of them can be quite aggressive towards you, and they just put up with it. They care for them. They're so gentle with them. They do everything that a loving family member would do, and you become quite close to them. And Dad became very close to the carers at Mum's nursing home. And I remember at Mum's funeral, there were probably 10 to 12 carers from the nursing home that turned up, because it was like family. And when Dad spends so much time in that nursing home, he saw the carers more than he saw his own family. So you develop these bonds with the people that are just amazing.
So through your mother's experience, what did you learn about the stages of Alzheimer's, and how did that progress for your mother?
There is no definitive sort of timeline with Alzheimer's. There is only indication of stages of, and there's 3 stages of Alzheimer's, and there's 7 stages. So you can go from whichever one you want to look for. But basically it's, you know, starting to slowly forget names and where you put things, and then it progresses all the way to basically your body shutting down. I guess everyone progresses at a different rate, obviously. And there are ways that you can do tests to find out what stage you're at by the behaviours that you're exhibiting. So for us, I think Mum was at stage 6 for quite a long time, which is, you know, non-verbal and couldn't really feed herself, was on vitamised food and was just basically existing. And then the stage 7 is essentially palliative care, where she couldn't swallow. She lost the swallowing function. And for me, that swallowing function was the one that I was always dreading. And then when we knew it was time that she was going to go is when she couldn't actually swallow any food at all. And we discovered actually that Dad was sneaking food into her mouth when she wasn't meant to be. When we'd even made the decision that she had to go on palliative care, we were with her as much as we could be those final days. And I remember sitting there watching Dad putting chocolate into her mouth. And I went over to the nurse and said, I know she's not meant to be fed. And she said, you know what, just let him do it. If it makes him feel better, then let him do it.
Michelle Wyatt.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera.
After 13 years with Alzheimer's disease, Michelle's mother passed away. They played Doris Day's Que Sera Sera at the funeral because it was one of her mum's favourites.
When I grew up and fell in love, I asked my sweetheart what lies ahead.
At your mother's funeral, it was the end of your mother's life, but it was also the end of several very difficult emotional years.
Yeah, it was. It's funny because, you know, we'd lost the physical mum years and years before because she couldn't really talk to us, or we didn't have that relationship where at the end of the day, if something great happened, I could pick up the phone and say, hey, mum, guess what happened? So I didn't have that relationship with mum for close to, you know, 7 to 8 years, I guess, the last 7 or 8 years of her life. So when she passed, it was just, it was a weird feeling. It was like I didn't have a loss in a physical sense. Nothing was really going to change in my life except for the trips up to the nursing home to visit. But it was an interesting thing. I remember when I was a kid, when my nana passed, we got a phone call and Dad answered the phone and then he went and said something to Mum, and it was at night. I was in bed, I remember, and I heard Mum say, "That's a relief." And I thought, how odd is that, that you would be relieved that your mother has died? I couldn't quite comprehend that as a 12-year-old. And I remember thinking, oh, I wonder when I get the call about Mum if it will be a relief. But it kind of wasn't, you know. It sort of was in one way, but in the other I was like, wow, it still hurts, you know what I mean? It's still really, really hard to know that the physical being is not there anymore. Mm. So I'm going to try not to get too upset here. but it was, yeah, it was an end of an era. So it was quite tough. Yeah.
And you obviously have a great love and respect for your father. How did this experience of your mother's Alzheimer's affect that?
A lot of the time, and it's going to sound a bit strange, I was very frustrated with Dad in that I know that his mission was to sit with Mum and he wanted to make sure she was fine. But we had lost our mother when she was diagnosed, essentially, in that we didn't have the relationship with her. But because Dad chose to be with her, we sort of lost him as well. So occasionally we would get frustrated and say, you know, Dad, why can't you just leave Mum? She's going to be fine. I promise you, just leave her for, you know, half a day and come and be at grandparents' day at my son's school. But he wouldn't do it. So it was an interesting relationship during that time. I would talk to him every single day and we would see him a couple of times a week. But it was not the relationship that we were used to prior to when Mum got sick. So it was all good. You know, there was no problems with our relationship in terms of, you know, I wasn't loving him as much as I did beforehand or didn't feel like he was my dad. It was sort of frustrating that we'd lost both parents and we didn't necessarily need to lose Dad. But, you know, if he hadn't been there, Mum would have passed a lot sooner. I'm convinced of that.
You tell a lovely, poignant story of your son's comments before he went to bed not long after your mother had passed away. Tell me about that.
That was funny. I walked in to put my son to bed, and I think he was five, and I was just laying him down, and he said, "Do you miss your mum?" And I said, "Of course I miss my mum." And he's like, "Does it make you sad?" Because he's a very dramatic kid and he loves to bring tears out of people. And he said, "It's okay, Mummy. She's up in heaven with Michael Jackson and he's looking after her." And I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure I've never really mentioned Michael Jackson to my five-year-old son. So I didn't comment. I just excused myself. And I walked out to the kitchen. I said to my husband, "Have you ever talked to Sam about Michael Jackson?" He said, "Nope." And I said, "Okay." So I walked back in and I said, "Okay, well, that's lovely. I'm glad Michael Jackson's looking after her. I'm pretty sure she'd be happy with Frank Sinatra looking after her, but Michael Jackson will work."
It's lovely. So what would you say to others, other families that are going through what you've been through?
Well, it's certainly not an easy thing to go through, and 99% of the time it's depressing and sad and grueling, you know, to see a loved one go through this, because it's a terminal illness. You know, I don't think people, when you say Alzheimer's, there's always a lot of jokes around it and people saying, "Oh, it must be the Alzheimer's, I forgot my keys." It's a terminal illness. There's no cure for it. So I think unless you really have a person you know that it's going through it, you don't really understand the severity of it and the sadness surrounding it, because you're seeing a loved one lost in their own little world and you can't get anything out of them. And I think you just have to put one foot in front of the other. That's what we did. We were there when we needed to be there and we understood it and we were just as compassionate as we could be to everyone else around us. But we also knew that it was important to take those timeouts to just sort of step back and say, okay, this is happening and there's nothing we can do about it. And just remember that, you know, you have to just continue with your own life and hopefully a cure is around the corner. I remember when I met with Mum's professor when she was first diagnosed and I said to him, well, you know, I'm looking down the barrel of it, aren't I? I was all, you know, making jokes about it. And he said, you know what, by the time you're 60, we'll have a cure. And I turned 50 a few months ago, so I'm going to hold him to it. But there's amazing research going on and they're already taking steps in the right direction. And I'm hoping just even by writing this book that perhaps will appeal to people that would not normally pick up a book on Alzheimer's. I'm hoping that this book then might bring the disease to people that don't really know about it and create a greater awareness of it and hopefully pushes in the right direction of finding a cure and helping raise funds for it and doing everything we can. But yeah, for us, it was just important to be there where we needed to be there, go along the journey, but also take a moment to stand back. And if you are do have a loved one in a nursing home and you see these things happening, it's okay to smile about it because everyone's going through it. They all understand and no one's going to think worse of you. If you say, you know what, a guy running through the room with no undies on is, you know, it can be pretty funny if you just think about the situation. And I think you do become a bit complacent about it when you spend so much time there and you see it all the time. It makes you sort of feel like, you know what, everyone's different and it's okay.
So knowing that Alzheimer's is in your family, how has that affected the way you feel about the likelihood of you getting the disease?
I think what it does do is make you question every single thing you forget, every wrong turn you take in a car, every time you forget a word. And it's like always at the forefront of your mind, I think. And I do worry about it. And I know there are tests you can have to see whether you carry the gene. I'm not going to have that test because I think if I knew today that I was going to get Alzheimer's, I would, part of you would give up, I think. I think it's almost be a self-fulfilling prophecy where you go downhill faster than you should. So I'm counting on the fact that they're going to be finding a cure pretty soon, or at least things that will help in people that are destined to get the disease. But knowing that I potentially am going to get Alzheimer's is not something that changes the way I live today.
And you've spoken to your husband, giving him the permission to move on once you don't recognise him anymore. But there are some conditions, aren't there?
There are. I said, okay, if I get it, that's fine. And as my mum said, you know, put me in a home, that's okay. I'm happy for you to move on, but you can't move on with these certain women. Ex-girlfriends, no. And you can't play this kind of music at your wedding and you can't go to these places on your honeymoon. And so there are conditions and I think that's important. I want to be open to him moving on, but I still want to have a bit of control.
Okay, thank you very much, Michelle Wyatt.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Michelle Wyatt's book, Not Right in the Head, is published by Allen & Unwin. Now I have chills. More information can be found on the All in the Mind webpage via RN. And leave a comment on the site there too. We'd love to hear from you. While you're there, sign up for the All in the Mind podcast, if you haven't done that yet. That way you won't miss an episode. Production today by Diane Dean and Judy Rapley. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Thanks for your company. See you next time. What will be, will be. Que será?